Hey, everybody, it's Talknosis, and I'm really excited and happy to have Dr. Alan Greenfield on the show. The last time Alan was on was about a decade ago, which is way too long. I'm a huge fan of his work. I give everybody the same intro, Alan, and then I usually say this, I give everybody the same intro, but it's true. We basically started the show so that we could talk to people who we admire, whose work has moved us, and have something to share with the world. And I think that's definitely you. I'm hoping that the people who already know your work are tuning in, but you know, there's going to be, you know, probably literally 1,000 or 2,000 people who are going to be watching or listening to this who don't know you. So I usually don't do a biography, but I was wondering, and this could be a whole show, you've lived a rich life, but I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about yourself and a bit about your spiritual autobiography.
Okay. I wish you hadn't ordered it, have lived a rich life. Yes, I have.
Yeah, sorry, you're living a rich life.
Despite the fact that I will come from the beyond when I am beyond, I'm not yet beyond, if you follow what I'm saying.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's the area I deal with. I have been involved in paranormal work, in ufology, and in alternative spirituality since 1960. That kind of dates me, you know, back when the dinosaurs ruled the earth, I was born. But it's just a lifelong interest with me. And my emphasis for a long time was in ufology. Then it sort of migrated to the occult, although I have never abandoned ufology because I eventually realized, after much trial and error, that the various fields, so-called, involving neurotheology, theology, which was my original, you know, graduate work at the University of Arizona. Never did anything with that, but, you know, it makes very literate conversation. And I got involved with the OTO, which I will not talk about because I spent 20 years there. I was made a bishop in the OTO, which is not applicable now because we got a divorce, I guess you could say. So a long time ago, actually. I have used the term following an earlier practitioner, congregational illuminism. I have clarified that to free illuminism and prefer the term, although, you know, I will accept if it's a group of people, it's a congregation almost by definition. I just have come to realize that, first of all of these different supposedly separate areas, cryptozoology, ufology, Gnosticism, conventional religion, spirituality, they all are different aspects of the same animal. And once I realized that, I mean, the thread that unites them, I think, is quantum physics, which I came to relatively late, about 20 years ago, but that's, you know, half of my field experience. I realized it's just different masks. Joseph Campbell, in the early days of his work, did a book called The Masks of God. And I think that term applies here. I prefer non-sectarian terminology. It's like, I will still, on occasion, do a consecration, but I prefer to call it an empowerment. During the course of the Great Arabian Mountain Working, which was 10 years long, I probably empowered or facilitated having empowered maybe 100 people. I prefer that term, empowerment, because consecration, although it's certainly true, I mean, my begots, you know, go back as far as you can go back in maybe four different lineages, but I prefer to think of it as an egregoric empowerment rather than something that has specifically Eastern Orthodox or Roman Catholic connotations. I mean, I was on UFO Hunters once, and the host, Bill Burns, who is a fellow Jew, first question was, how can you be bishop and a Jew? And I said, it's a Masonic title, which was the best I could come up with for that length of time. But, you know, that is close enough. I mean, on the site where I cite my begots, which is not something I refer to that often, there's a little section that says, what Alan Greenfield really believes, which is not quite true because I don't believe anything. I think, I speculate, subject to new inputs. But it goes straight to the Reform Judaism site and the most recent declaration from there. So I don't know if that's an overwinded or underwinded answer, but there you go. No, that's how we are here.
Yes, yeah. I'll have to link in the show notes to the website that you mentioned what Alan Greenfield actually believes. And I think it's interesting. You know, some people are going to be turning off the show or, you know, running away when they hear about ufology or I can never say it right, ufology. But we had a...
Ufology. Most people, I'm a second-gen ufologist. All the first-geners are dead. Some of my generation have gone on to their reward in the great UFO in the sky. But the term ufology has fallen into ufology. It's just, I get, and, you know, I'm way too polite, way too Southern to correct people, but it's ufology. So if you miss, the one I won't abide is ufology. It's some people use. And it fits the term, but nevertheless, it doesn't fit the reality of the situation, except for certain people.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a Dr. David Halpern on the show who wrote a very...
He's second gen, too, and we started out together. So.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And he, he talks about the... 15th century, 16th century, 17th century Kabbalists, right, having similar experiences to what we now call the UFO experience and experiences with the men in black. And just like you were saying, that you don't necessarily have beliefs, you know, that's something that I really kind of struggle with, think about, because I'm always shifting, I'm always changing, I'm always waking up on a different side of the bed. And, you know, it's kind of hard to be in flux. You know, sometimes I wish, you know, I should just go around the corner and join the Evangelical Baptist Church that's there. And I'm not saying I'm superior to anybody who has a rigid belief system. It's tough. It's hard sometimes. Can you tell us how you understand and define Gnosticism and Gnosis?
Okay, that's a very interesting question. I tend to go to the Eastern equivalents to the term. For me, when I say Gnosticism, I am not particularly referring to, although I certainly am aware of it and literate in it, the classical Gnostics of Roman times, because they are saturated, as are, I guess, all religions of that period, with notions that I find, Gnosis means radical, direct, intuitive knowledge of reality, as opposed to intellectual knowledge or beliefs. In fact, it's the opposite of the notion of beliefs. If you believe something, you take it on faith as currently defined. But as Karen Armstrong has pointed out, the original meaning of faith was fides, the Roman term, which is allegiance. So if someone asks me point blank, do you believe in God? Meaning, I assume they mean the Judeo-Christian general idea. I would have to say, no, with reservations, which is to say, if you revise the question, which no poll taker is going to do, I would say, ask me, do you think that there is a God in the sense of an omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient being? I would say, yeah, I think so. Do you owe allegiance to that concept? Yes, even if it doesn't exist, I owe allegiance to it because it's one of the great pillars of Western civilization, which I happen to, you know, be a product of. So to me, Gnosis is cutting through that to direct, radical, intuitive knowledge of what is and what isn't. It's not something you can prove through a second person. You can tell them what you've done to reach that point of view, but you can't prove it yourself because it's direct and radical and intuitive. Have I explained it or just confused things more?
No, I think you've explained it well. So sifting a little bit, but coming back to sort of your intro, you know, you mentioned trying to explain this bishop title and that it's a Masonic title. And I was wondering if you could explain to us a very peculiar and interesting form of Masonry known as Memphis Mizraim. What is Memphis Mizraim?
I think that you have to distinguish the Memphis Mizraim system from Orthodox Freemasonry. It was quite Orthodox in the 19th century and a rival of what in America is free and accepted Masonry, FNAM Masonry, and also ancient and accepted Masonry, the two forms that you get most of in the United States. But those forms are confined to men, and in their classical form, they're confined to white adult men. And I don't particularly care for that kind of bigotry. In fact, the Ku Klux Klan was an offspring of mainstream Freemasonry. Memphis Mizraim traces its origin back to the Comte Cagliostro and has whether what he was doing or saying was embroidered or not. It came forward through the Rite of Memphis in the early 1820s, and then further down the line through the Rite of Mizraim, and then late in the 19th century, because they met with a lot of hostility, as they admit women, they admit people of color, they admit people who are interested in what they do, regardless of race, creed, color, or national origin. The particular Memphis Mizraim group that I am involved with is the World Association of Egyptian Freemasonry and organization. And their headquarters is in Yafo, one of the most ancient cities in the world. And if you look at a picture from one of their ceremonies, it looks like pretty much like any kind of Masonic ceremony. But the difference is you will see women, you will see in the divisions that you see in the Holy Land right behind me here, you will see people taking sides. But the truth is you have people of Islamic Arabic extraction, Jews from Russia, Jewish converts from America. You have all kinds of people. And that is a reflection of how WAEO operates. So I think that you would call it a liberal Masonic tradition. Now, it is true that in my own work, I have found inspired by Dr. Michael Bertio, who empowered me at the very beginning of my career, shall we say, outside of the OTO, Memphis Mizraim represents a current that goes beyond the ceremonial mystery plays that Freemasonry almost universally uses. And I have found that it is quite the case that there is a non-ceremonial way that one can accomplish the degrees, the many, many degrees in the Rites of Memphis and Mitzrayim. And I'm a promoter of that. There is nothing wrong with the ceremonial initiations. Heaven knows, in my OTO days, I was an initiator up to a quite high degree, but and I wouldn't have done it if I didn't think that it was, that's probably the best thing that they have to offer, although it's been corrupted by the present. Oh, I'm not talking about that. Oh, okay. Not talk about them, Alan. Okay. You're talking to your hand, Alan. Okay. Having a sense of humor, by the way, is what keeps people sane in this area. People that don't have a sense of humor always wind up going down a bad, bad path sooner or later. Or just...
I completely agree. And you know, that's something I in a way, I almost look for people involved in this stuff. You know, you don't want to make it all a joke or be too light. But yeah, if you don't have a sense of humor, I think you're right. It pushes people to, what's the word I'm looking for? Insanity, the bad kind. There is something about having a sense of humor about all this stuff. Because some of it's pretty weird that really helps in a strange way is grounding.
Yeah, that is the case. And there are people that I have known over the many years that I've been involved in this stuff that have, I don't know, gone to the dark side of the force, which I say with a certain amount of humor, but tragically, some of those are suicides. Some of them are just, well, it's not a medical term, but they're nuts, totally wacko. And I still hear from some of these people, but I've stopped trying to say, do you think maybe you should see a physician? Because that drives them. And I take all these things with something of a grain of salt, but only a grain, you know, if there is something that is evidential. I mean, I was having a debate earlier today about near-death experiences, and I think there is a very good case for they are being a manifestation of something quite real and outside the brain that questions the nature of consciousness in a very big way. But there is a group of people who believe in it, and it's an article of faith in the current sense of the word faith, not in the sense of fidens, loyalty, or fidelity, actually, literally. And therein lies madness. But of course, there is a group of people who are equally nuts that are what I used to call professional skeptics. And I happened across the term pseudo-skeptics. And since anything they disagree with, they call pseudoscience, I've decided pseudo-skeptic is a really good term for them. That is, it's the same people, some of whom I knew. I'll mention the ones that have passed on. I knew the amazing Randy, James Randy, very, very well. And I knew a couple of the others that were involved in this, but you see the same four or five names all the time. And they're, as far as I know, all members of the American Humanist Association, which has a position which, you know, is fine, but don't tell me that that's science. They are committed to materialism. They may be ethical materialists, if that's possible, but they are materialists, and by definition, that means that they are going to look for something frantically that explains anything that seems to be outside of material science. And the funny thing about that is, in my lifetime already, material science has changed enormously from I'm trying to think of a specific example. When I was in high school, this again will date me, but that's okay. When I was in high school, they were teaching that continental drift was a myth. That was early 1960s. Of course, now it's the accepted orthodox norm, and there is an elaborate jigsaw puzzle notion about the breakup of the continents. It's, I think people are idolatrous towards science. And the truth is, science is made up of scientists. And scientists are just as subject to the bigotries and prejudices that any other human beings are. I am, you are, they are. And in science, there is a consensus of opinions that if you don't toe the line to, the entire scientific community comes down on you and even goes to non-scientists. So there is a worst case that would be Wilhelm Reich, who I think was onto something that would now be called dark energy, that he called Orgone. And he wound up going to prison and dying there. And his body burned on a beach. You know, that's insane.
Agree. And I think even people who find Reich kooky, like, you know, his, at least, there's a lot of stuff in his early writings that is very powerful. And of course, I like all of his writings. I like his later work. I like his later writings. But I think that he was onto something, even if you don't want to go into the kookiness. And you know, to kind of tie things into the classical Gnosticism of a couple thousand years ago, you know, you mentioned idolatry. You know, I think the Gnostics, they took the classic Judaic, Christo-Judaic fear and terror of idolatry to the next level, right? Where you have this fake god that people worship. And I think that that's a really powerful metaphor, something really powerful for the modern day, because it's become kind of a hack observation to point out that as society gets more secular, in a weird way, people get more religious. They just find new fake gods to bow down to. And, you know, I'm a pretty big fan of science, medical science, all kinds of science. But at the same time, I think you're really onto something there where people have made that a new god, and that will be a fake god that will fail them at some point, as is every god that we make for ourselves, as is every idol that we have decided to put in place. But Alan, I wanted to come back to something that you mentioned earlier when we were talking about Memphis Misraim. So there's something like 93, 99 degrees. Each of them, most of them have a kind of ritualistic play where the person receives this degree. But you mentioned that you found a way, discovered a way where people can get the empowerment of each degree without this elaborate setup, without this ritual, without this play. So can you tell us a little bit about that and what that has to do with hot points, with Hua Shou?
The Pui Shou, yeah. First of all, I would not urge anyone to attempt to scribe the degrees without first being empowered by someone who has the appropriate empowerment, because it's a very dangerous route. But if you have the proper empowerment and, you know, a good sense of humor that you can spend three hours a week watching cartoons or equivalent, then you probably can use this technique. There's a little booklet that I put together very early on in consultation with Dr. Bertio back when we were working along the same lines. And I would be glad to send that free for nothing to anybody who, you know, sends me a request for it. It's very hard to describe in, you know, just talking on a program with limited time, but basically it involves trans channeling, decoding, using the secret cipher, the Euphonauts, which is one of my books, and also something that is important to me, and obtaining the word and password of the particular degree as it applies to the individual. And I base that on the fact that in regular Freemasonry and in Luther's Mitraism, there are these signs and grips and words that are kind of extraneous to the content of the degree, kind of, but that are nevertheless part of the process of obtaining the degree. And they usually represent a part of the human body, for example, or an understanding of fraternity by a grip, which goes back to the craft masonry of the most ancient sort, or other aspects of that. And when I became aware through reading Dr. Berdiaux's work that, first of all, he considered Memphis Mitraim a gift from, well, he would say E.T. or did say, I would say from the ultra-terrestrial sources, which is my take on that. And that being the case, since he also strongly advocated using these hot points, or we shall, or polished shell, as we say in the South, it could be that we're talking about the same thing in these symbolic initiations that's being discussed in ceremonial mystery plays. And I have found that that is the case, and some of my most talented, I don't want to call them students now because they are, you know, empowered on their own. So basically, you learn to trance. You trance with the idea of that degree in mind. You come up with a phrase from a significant book to you. That could be, if you were, God forbid, a Thelemite, it would be probably the Brava Legis. Or if you were an Orthodox Jew, God help you, you would get it from the Hebrew Scriptures. If you were a devout Christian, you would probably get it from Revelations. But or if you were a Gnostic, maybe you would look for the hypostasis of the Archons, which I think is about the Black Lodge, which is my current book. But in any case, you would obtain those same underlying Jungian archetypal facts, which is, by the way, what my friend Dave Halpern thinks that the entire mystery, I don't know if you'd call it reduces, I don't think he would. Archetypes are profound. Ask Carl Jung. Ask him now and see what you get. But I think that there is something more. I try to avoid the term objective because I don't think there is any such animal. But let's say more in touch with notions like ultra-terrestrials and other membranes of reality that somehow have portals to our bone. So this is a roundabout answer, but you asked a very, very broad question. But if people learn the technique, all I can say is try it yourself without prejudice. And if you want to run it by me, that's fine. I'll be glad to take a look at what you've come across. And if it's a no sale, which has happened a couple of times, I'll politely say, try it again. But if, as is usually the case, if you do it correctly, as in the little booklet that I put together long ago, and that Al Palamas was kind enough to turn into a rather nice booklet as opposed to my 1990s typewritten, not-so-nice form. I think that you probably will get some very interesting results. Is that answering without answering? Because that's what it sounded like to me. If I was listening to me, I'd think he's not telling us what he's trying to tell us. Well, there's a lot of that going on. That's where gnosis comes in.
That's just about what I was going to say. It was, you know, that answer was pretty similar to your answer about how do you define Gnosticism and Gnosis, and people will just have to find out for themselves. But for some more clarification, actually, you know, your question leads to a question from me. But you mentioned free illuminism. What is that?
Well, it's sort of what it sounds like, except that I keep getting mail asking to join the Illuminati. And forgive me, I don't think the Illuminati has existed since Adam Weishaupt was suppressed by the Elector of Bavaria in the 1700s. So, I mean, there was an attempt by Theodore Royce to revive it in the, I guess, 1880s or 1890s, and it didn't go anywhere. So then he founded the OTO with Carl Kildner. Which is another story. But free illuminism is sort of the opposite of the lodges of magic, as Madame Blavatsky refers to them, approach to the path to enlightenment, which is to say, gnosis, which is to say becoming a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. Depends on the culture, what term you use, same thing. Those systems tend to rely on a teacher or a rigid system of initiation. That would include the Golden Dawn, the OTO, the various claimants to the AA, and a bunch of others, all of which have a very steady curriculum. Free Illuminism starts out with the premise that there are empowerments that, wherever you got them, they should be free for nothing for all, and that once an individual or a group is empowered, either by laying on of hands or by being chartered or both, hopefully both, what direction they take it in is their own thing. And what I describe as the Great Arabia Mountain Working, which went on for 10 years, anyone who came in peace to the mountain on a certain day each month in the warmer months, and that would be my part of the universe, from roughly March to roughly October. If they asked for an empowerment, they got it. Again, free for nothing. And if they asked for a charter, I would send them some sample charters that were actually in force at that time, and probably still, because they do tend to stick. For the price of an envelope with a stamp on it. And that, which is to say, not for the price, but you have to fold one into. I get people, as I was telling you before the program, I encourage people to enclose a stamped, self-addressed return envelope, because that saves me a lot of time and trouble. But other than that, the only thing involved is you have to draw your own charter, and I'll be glad to show you the general, you know, format. I got one today that had one mistake in it that was a technical mistake. And I said, well, if you reverse this, go ahead and send me the charter, and I will sign, seal, and deliver it back to you. Don't forget the SRESE, which is a term that has become sort of obsolete, but hey, that's a necessity of my particular circumstances. However, each free illuminist is a sovereign unto themselves, and each free illuminist body is sovereign unto itself. If, let's say, I charter them, let's say I ordain or empower them. Once that is given, we follow a species of the Augustinian doctrine, once a bishop, always a bishop. Once a lodge, always a lodge. And I guess the closest I get to faith in anything is faith in once in power, once chartered. I have no ability to take that charter away or to disempower that person. Now, if they turn out to be a neo-Nazi or something, I have the same freedom that you do and everyone else does to say, I don't agree with that. I am not in association with that. Or not. I can choose either way. But the whole point is that they are their own power zone, use Dr. Bertio's term. And power zones have a very interesting way of righting themselves if they're on the path, so to speak. Is that lucid enough?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's a really great explanation. You're pretty prolific. You know, I love all of your writing, and I'm wondering if you're working on any new books or writing projects right now.
Oh, I spent the last year struggling with this book that Olaf Phillips and I have been working on the Black Lodge. And let me explain that a little bit, because it's not self-explanatory. First of all, I'm constrained to say, just like the term the Great White Brotherhood, it has no racial connotations at all. It refers to the traditional black magic, white magic sort of thing. And I had originally, when I wrote Secret Cipher, the Huguenots, and the sequel, which was written at the same time, Secret Rituals of the Men in Black, to make it a trilogy. And the way I envisioned it was that the third volume would get away from the numbers, which feature very heavily in the Kabbalistic accounts in the first two books, and go for the secret chiefs of the Third Order, which still needs clarification. People who are deeply into the weeds of magic know what that refers to. It's basically, I think people, ironically, in Western society who are, you know, in touch with this, will understand the term bodhisattva from Buddhism more quickly than they'll understand secret chiefs. Or the theosophical term, ascended masters. Same thing, Lamed Vav mix in traditional Judaism. For their sake is the universe preserved. 35 righteous people. There are all sorts of, the nine unknown in India comes from the same foundation. The numbers should tell you that we don't know the numbers. The numbers may change. But the fact is, these are ascended beings who used to be human, as distinguished from beings who are never human, but who have benevolent intentions towards the human race. We're not talking about archons and the demiurgos. We're talking about the angelic and the positive, and most of all, I would think, those beings that were part of the human race, but have done the equivalent of taking the bodhisattva oath, which amounts to, we will not go on to nirvana until all sentient beings have achieved nirvana. And given the vastness of the universe that we, maybe universes that we now know, that is a tall order and a long time project. So, where do we want to go with that?
Well, if you could bring it back to the book, why the Black Lodge then? So you're talking about people who are here helping us. So what's that got to do with this book that you're writing?
Well, when I got around to considering writing it about the secret chiefs, I thought there was a more pressing matter. My opinion is we live in very dark times that make it a lot darker.
I concur.
That would be all spheres of life. I think Western civilization is in deep trouble. I think democracy is in deep trouble. I think, having grown up under the threat of nuclear war during the Cold War, I kind of thought we were done with that. But we didn't pursue disarmament with the kind of vigor that I hoped. And I think we're dealing with that threat again. And in addition, the sun is acting very peculiar, you know, our sun. And as the universe goes, the nearby star Betelgeuse, and we're not talking about the guy in the movie, we're talking about a star, seems to be about to go supernova. About to, referring to the whole universe, can be thousands or millions of years, but might be tomorrow. So there are a lot of disturbing elements, particularly when we were speaking about Graham Hancock's view of a comet or asteroid hitting the Earth 11,000 years ago, for which there's some evidence. There's an alternative theory from a much smaller group of fringe people, which may or may not be true, that the sun had a catastrophic emission which changed everything and brought on the Younger Dryas. The same evidence is used, different conclusions, different group of people. I don't know whether that's the case, but if that happened 11,000 years ago, and some of the things that I'm seeing in astronomy right now, maybe it happened again. And the minimum effect would be, well, we wouldn't be talking right now, not through this medium, because in theory, all of our records could be erased. Our communications could be down for years, if not decades. And who knows what knowledge could be lost? Maybe all of it. Maybe we would have to go back to being phoneless.
What a horrible fate.
Yeah. Well, yeah. For Gen Y and Gen Z, it would be, you know, catastrophic. And I say that with humor, but I also say that, you know, it literally is how they live. You know, if it's not TikTok, it's not real. So I decided to write a book about the underlying force that is the opposite of the bodhisattva or the secret chiefs, because it is something that was much discussed in the magic during the Findishishal of the 19th to 20th century, but it stopped being discussed around 1920 for reasons that I don't know, probably political reasons. The last was Aleister Crowley's novel, Moonchild, which talked about that openly. Well, he may have been at the Black Lodge for all I know, or at least informed by a being from the Black Lodge. But the idea is not a bunch of scumbag mobsters who mean ill towards civilization. That's always been true, and it's true of ordinary people. And many of them are doing 10 to 20 to life in prison, and many of them are prospering here, there, and Abu Dhabi. Whoops, shouldn't have mentioned the name of where they're hiding out. But mostly of the Russian persuasion. But we're talking about adepts who advance to a certain point in terms of the Ithyam, the tree of life. They have advanced to just below the most perilous path of all, the path of Gimel, the camel, which goes all the way to the upper triad of the tree of life. In other words, to enlightenment, they prefer to stay in what Quilly called the city of the pyramids, below that. But at the same, because they're afraid of it, it is a risky proposition. According to the general magical lore, if you fall off, you get eaten by the lord of the abyss and turned into nothingness, which I believe to be impossible, but nevertheless, that is the mythos. And they take that seriously and don't want to go beyond, but they also don't want to be outranked. So people still physically embody, not alternately those who are ascended, but have taken the opposite tack, they oppose. And while I don't think there's an official organization called the Black Lodge, if they call themselves something, I don't know what it is, but there are many manifestations of the Black Lodge and of organizations and individuals who are fueled, knowingly or unknowingly, by the Black Lodge, that are counterproductive on the path. There you have my version of the demiurgos manifesting in day-to-day reality. So I went to my publisher. We got lots and lots of interference, a lot of different types. So it took us a year not to assemble our stuff, but to be able to publish it. And even now, there is some rather vicious stuff that goes on. To me, that just validates what we're saying, that there is a Black Lodge and they don't like what we're doing, so we must be doing something right. So that is the story of how this book came to be written. And I keep forgetting the name because we went back and forth on that a lot of times too, but I think it's Secrets of the Real Black Lodge Revealed. Real is in there because we want to distinguish it a little bit from David Lynch's Twin Peaks Black Lodge, although Lynch is very close to being an enlightened being himself and was probably deliberately talking about this stuff. He gets a free copy.
Yeah. Well, it does seem like his Black Lodge is pretty similar to what you're talking about. But that's as good as any place to start wrapping up. Alan, it's been amazing talking to you. I'm really going to be looking forward to that. Do you have a release date for the Black Lodge book?
I know that it's available. You can post it. It's available on Amazon, Amazon UK, Amazon Canada, I think has it, and Barnes & Noble has it. Now, whether they have it in their stores yet, because it just came out like 2 weeks ago, I don't know, but you can order it through the stores or you can order it online. I get stuff from Barnes & Noble all the time, and I always order online. A bad habit I developed during COVID, you know, don't go somewhere where you can order online. But I would encourage people to first of all, not to overplug it, but the first two books in that series have been published together, called The Complete Secret Cipher of the Euphonox. Eventually, there will be a more complete Secret Cipher of the Euphonox with this one and folded into it, because the current standalone edition of The Complete Secret Cipher of the Euphonox is a good prelude to the Black Lodge book, and I would suggest that you read it. I meant it to be sort of standalone, but it will definitely be a richer experience if you read the entire trilogy.
Excellent. Okay, well, we'll put some links in the show notes. We'll also link to your homepage and other links of interest related to your work. And I think that's it for now, but hopefully you'll come back on the show and we'll have another conversation about all of this stuff. So, Alan, thanks again so much.
God willing, I'll be back.
Bye.
Bye-bye.